Welcome to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
My name is Jill.
And my name is Michael.
Catch us every other Wednesday talking about books, publishing, indie bookstores, chatting with authors, and so much more.
Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Book It Pod for more Book It content.
Want to read something you heard about on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/BookItPod.
We want to give a huge shout out to today's sponsor, the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, which is a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio, but more on them later.
Hey, Michael.
Oh, good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
This is our first AM recording, I think.
I think you might be right, and I'm already having a Coke Zero.
I'm on my second cup of coffee.
And
I'm in my pajamas.
I had to ask Michael what the settings should be on my computer and my phone.
Yeah, it's fine. And I was not 100% sure. So Who knows how this will go. It's funny because I am a morning person, but I'm a morning person in the sense of like, I like a long morning to like to have my brain not work.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I have to. I'm a night owl, so it takes me.
You sure are.
What time did I text you last night?
I woke up to a text from Jill. Was it like 11:45? Which, like, to other people is probably not very late, but no. I was like, had my earplugs in, my mask on, my three fans running, like, was asleep.
I will say, now that I know that your phone doesn't make any noise. Like, I used to really temper myself because I know you go to bed earlier than I do, and I would not text you as late as I might. But now that we know each other better and I know that your phone never makes any noise, I feel free to text you at whatever time something occurs to me.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I won't hear it and I won't respond until the next morning and likely won't respond until we're talking.
Yes. Yes. I love that.
Speaking of which, I, the other night, had a wild dream about you that I thought our listeners would be interested in hearing.
I can't wait.
So if you're listening, if you're a listener, you'll know that Jill's in the midst of a pretty big home renovation project.
Yes.
And I will say for Jill too, like, every single COVID restriction is in place. Like, it's a very safe situation that she's in doing it.
Yes. Our poor contractor is zipped into a zipper pod every day.
you do what you gotta do for money.
Yeah. 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 It's three floors of total destruction here.
And so I've been getting, Jill and I are friends, so I've been getting updates. I had a dream about her renovations, and she was going like full 1970s vibe with her look. I'm talking crimson velvet carpet on the walls. Oh, wow. And yeah, she had me over. You had me over for the big reveal, and I was trying so hard to be supportive, and I just kept saying, I love that you did whatever you wanted. And that was the most diplomatic thing I could say.
My favorite thing, I have two favorite things. One is I love that I have creeped into your subconscious when you're asleep. Yes. But secondly, what I just adore about this story is that if I really did this, you are such a nice and kind and supportive person that's literally what you would say in real life. Like, I'm so happy for you, but you would mean it genuinely.
Yes, that would be the truth. Yes. Yeah, I would be so happy that you got what you wanted.
I feel like, I mean, if I knew how to use Photoshop, I would make it look like I had done that to one of my rooms.
And send it to me.
And send it to you. I don't have those skills. I'll ask my children. Maybe my children can do it for me.
Another part, you had taken me into your bedroom and there was fabric hanging from the ceiling, from the center of the ceiling out, because you wanted it to look like a circus tent. Oh, no. And you kept asking me to go lay on your bed so I could get the full effect.
No, it's so inappropriate.
I know. But that's when I said, I love that you did what you wanted. I love you got what you wanted.
Have I told you that there did used to be circus tent stripes in our house?
Yes. Oh my gosh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, when we bought the house, two of the rooms had contrasting color striped walls. Two, not one, two.
It had an effect on dream version of Jill. She was inspired by that.
Your subconscious was traumatized just by the mention deeply of it.
Yeah. But I just thought my dream self, it was just like a very kind lie I told you.
The segue. Today, we are going to talk a little bit more about the kindest lie. But the big excitement is that we have this bonus episode because Michael and I got to chat with author Nancy Johnson, and she is delightful.
And yeah, so this is coming out. You've already listened to our book club conversation. So this is like, yeah, like Jill said, our extra special, literal extra episode. And she was so, I've had this experience on the podcast before where like I liked the book a lot. And then talking to the author, I was like, wow, I love this book. Because of course, you learn so much about more about the author, why they did the work, and just, I don't know, you, it gives you a little bit, I mean, it should give you more respect for the process, because yeah. I mean, listeners will hear this was a long time coming for her.
I am excited for everybody to hear it, because literally right off the bat with like the second question we ask her, it's like Michael and I's jaws were like on the floor. Right.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah, she was so sweet, and yeah, so I'm just really looking forward to it. And hopefully this is the setup we hope to do with book club books, is we have a book club chat, and hopefully we can always bring you the extra episode with the author interview. And I think we nailed it with this first one.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm excited for people to listen. I will say we didn't get super spoiled. We didn't get super spoilery, but if you are in the middle of the book, you might want to pause on this episode and come back after you've finished.
Totally. I'm so excited. Please sit back and enjoy this amazing interview with Nancy Johnson. So if you're a returning listener, you'll have heard us talk about the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, a Cincinnati-based nonprofit indie bookstore where for every book purchased, they donate one to a child in need.
We have been so lucky to have BMLP as our featured indie bookstore so far.
Yeah, BMLP gets out into the community, bringing authors and books to under-resourced schools, helping community reading initiatives get off the ground, and so much more. They've donated 40,000 books in the Cincinnati area.
And the number is growing every day. Blue Manatee is chock full of book people trying to spread all that book love. You can learn more about them online at bluemanatee.org or over on Instagram at bluemanateebooks.
All right, Nancy Johnson has worked for more than a decade as an Emmy-nominated and award-winning television journalist at CBS and ABC affiliates in markets nationwide. She is a graduate of Northwestern University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she currently lives in downtown Chicago and manages brand communications for a large nonprofit. The Kindest Lie is her first novel and our first book club selection, and we are so excited to have her on the podcast today. Welcome, Nancy, and congratulations on the publication.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you, Michael and Jill.
Oh, we are so excited to have you here today and to talk about The Kindest Lie. Could you kick us off with a brief synopsis of the book?
Sure. The Kindest Lie is a story of family, love, sacrifice, all of it at the intersection of race and class at the dawn of the Obama era. And the story itself centers on a woman named Ruth Tuttle. She's this successful Ivy League educated Black engineer in Chicago, very much on the come up. You know, she's got the great husband, brand new home. The world is her oyster, but she's been harboring a major secret. She gave birth to a baby when she was just a teenager, and she left him behind in the dying Indiana factory town where she grew up. So she decides she needs to reconcile with her past. So she goes back to her hometown to search for her son. And when she gets there, of course, nothing is the same. It's not as she remembers it. The auto plant that was the beating heart of that town is now closed. And a lot of folks, including her own brother, are out of work. And then she reunites with her brother and her grandmother, who she hasn't seen in years, and they're caring and keeping secrets of their own. And also when Ruth goes back to her hometown, she meets and she forms this unlikely connection with a young white boy nicknamed Midnight. And the two of them are put on this collision course of race and class, and their lives are upended.
Yeah, if we could, I'd love to start at the beginning because
sure.
I love that the book begins at the end of Ruth being able to keep this secret and how it's equal parts a secret and a secret that she's been keeping from others and also a lie she's been telling herself. Did you always know that this was where you wanted to begin your story?
I did. It's interesting. When you think about beginnings of books, it's always hard to know where to begin. You know, all the writing instructors tell you kind of start at the moment when everything changes. But for me, one of my great influences is Toni Morrison, the author. And, and I thought about my favorite work of hers, which was her first, The Bluest Eye. Mm-hmm. And I thought about, you know, when she started The Bluest Eye, she talked immediately about, she told you right off the bat about Picola Breedlove being this girl who had been molested by her father and had a baby by her father. And she said, now I'm going to tell, so that's what happened. But now I'm going to spend the rest of this book telling you how this came to be. And I use a very similar approach in The Kind of Lie with letting you know right away the secret that Ruth has been carrying, that she had this baby as a teenager and that she's been, that's been a weighty secret she's been carrying all these years. And then the rest of the book is about how that secret has impacted her life and impacted the people around her.
I am struck also talking about the beginning in the next successive chapter where we're at Obama's inauguration night in time. And obviously, I mean, this was written during the Trump presidency, but one of the things I was struck
actually, it was
by,
not written. It was not written during the Trump presidency. No. I wrote this book a long time ago. I wrote it during the second term of Obama's presidency.
That's fascinating.
That is so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't know Trump was coming.
No one did. Right. I was really struck. Michael and I were talking about this by what an amazing job you did of just like capturing the jubilant hope that I think was just like permeated everywhere. Yeah. It was nice post-election to kind of snuggle in and be like, can we feel hope again?
Right.
That's so true.
Yeah, gosh, that's fascinating. Did you start writing?
Yeah, so I started writing it, at the beginning of Obama's second term. And I was inspired by what I had seen when Obama was elected, you know, for the first time in 2008. It was a time of great hope, you know, certainly for me and for my family. You know, and I'll just tell you a personal story that it was bittersweet for me and 2008 because my father was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer that year. And so I knew that his cancer was terminal. And there was this moment where he was in the hospital struggling with lung cancer. And you know how the doctors ask a patient, you know, certain questions just to see how lucid you are, like, well, what's the day of the week? And so the doctor asked my father when he was sick, who's the president? And this was in October of 2008. And my father in this croaky voice said, Barack Obama. Oh. And the doctor said, not yet. You know, we haven't had the election yet. And so I knew that my father would be too sick probably to go out and vote by election day. So I convinced him to vote early, which he did. And so here's a man who had survived World War II, the Great Depression, and Jim Crow. And he cast the last vote of his life for America's first Black president. And so that was very meaningful. And he died a couple weeks after Election Day. So he did get to live to see that. So it was a time of hope for our family. I think it was a time of hope for so many around the country, particularly in Black America. And so that's where that celebratory mood comes from that you see in that opening. But I think even people who are not Black and people from different political persuasions felt like we had achieved something important and meaningful as a country, electing the first Black president. But the problem came in. Here's where my thought for the novel sparked. You had all these people saying, now that we've got a Black president, we're in a post-racial era. Mm-hmm. But I knew that was not the case. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw the vitriol on my social media feed, you know, and then in Obama's first term, you know, you saw the racial violence during his presidency with Trayvon Martin. And then you saw the Charleston, South Carolina church shooting, and just so much, you know, and so much of a backlash against having a Black president. And mm-hmm. so I wanted to explore that divide between Black and white America. And so that's, you know, where the story was birthed. And it's just coincidental that so many things that happened then are parallel with where we are as a country right now.
Which I think says so much about how not enough has changed that you could have written this before the last 4 years happened. And it's still so relevant, and how much work we have yet to do is so incredible. I mean, I actually, it's really extraordinary to me that this was written before the last 4 years, but that begs the question, did much change about the book because of the last 4 years?
No, I didn't make any right. change. I thought about, you know, some of the things that were going on, because I was still, you know, in the process of, you know, doing writing and editing on mm-hmm. the book during the Trump presidency. But no, I didn't make any changes because of that. But I think what I did, though, was just think about the themes a bit more and maybe mm-hmm. try to deepen those because of what I saw in terms of the parallels. So in 2008, we were going through this period of economic mm-hmm. despair because of the Great Recession in 2008. A lot of people, like I said, plants were closing. People were losing their homes, their jobs, their livelihoods. And then that parallels with where we are right now as a country, you know, with the pandemic and people losing jobs and going through the same kind of economic despair. And when you're going through that financial strain, it exacerbates the racial tensions. So I think that's the one part, is just looking at kind of deepening that piece about the connection between financial strain and stress and the racial divide. So that was important to me.
Yeah. Well, and you maybe just now answered this, but something that struck me about the book was the political implications around this personal revelation. Like many of us, we felt this macro sense of hope and change around us in 2008. But in reality, Ruth's life is a little unchanged. She's not moving forward in her career the way she should be and the way she has every right to be. And this piece of her past is meeting her present. And also how Ruth, going back home, she sees how differently the world is from her life in Chicago, or she's reminded of that. It's just a perfect exploration of macro change in a micro reality. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's definitely what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I wanted to explore these larger socio-political, you know, macro issues, but obviously I don't want to write a book that's going to be moralistic or didactic, you know, mm-hmm. you know, it's not a treatise on race in America, you know, but I had to make it more personal and more intimate right. with one person's life. And that's what I tried to do with Ruth's character. And, you know, you're so right about that, Michael, that this was my way of showing that even with this sense of hope and celebration that we started the book off with, there's still, like you said, so much that hasn't changed mm-hmm. for Black America. Mm-hmm. And even for a woman like Ruth, because the myth is that, oh, you've got a Black president. Oh, so life is good for Black people. No, that doesn't trickle down, you know, to every Black person just because right. you've got this symbol of success sitting in the highest office in the land. And so I wanted to look at Ruth. Like you said, she's stuck in her career. She's not able to get promoted. She's not getting the best assignments. You know, she's still being marginalized. And then when she goes back home, she sees her family and she sees the conditions of Black folks there who are stuck, you know, and then she also, you know, gets to see a slice of white America that is also stuck as well. Cause I wanted to show that because I think that was a big part of what we saw in 2008. You had so many in white America saying, you don't really see us and our struggles, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. But yet I also wanted to show in the book that even though white America and pockets of white America were suffering, there's still that element of white privilege
exactly.
that gives white America a leg up in spite of the economic insecurity.
Yeah, that was, for me, that piece of this personal, Ruth's personal story really connected with me. You did such a masterful job of capturing the challenge we face in talking about white privilege. Corey's family reminded me, not Corey, Midnight's family reminded me a great deal of my husband's extended family who lives in, you know, coal country here in Ohio, and how hard it can be to see privilege when you look around and you see so many challenges in your own life. And Michael and I talked to Connie Schultz last year about her book, Daughters of Erietown, which kind of touched on similar themes in the Rust Belt. And Michael and I were talking, you and Connie kind of share a similar background in journalism. And she mentioned that her years as a reporter being kind of incredibly helpful in framing that piece of the narrative. And I'm curious if you had similar feelings.
Definitely. I think that is a great link to make there. Because I did work as a television news reporter for 11 years before, you know, transitioning out of it. But I went into so many communities. You know, I started my career in Wisconsin, you know, and I went into a lot of rural Wisconsin communities. You know, I did endure racism on the job in some of the communities I went into as a reporter. You know, and I saw the differences, you know, just between several cities. Like I could be in the more cosmopolitan Madison and, you know, see a certain experience that, you know, that people were having, and then go into a more rural area of northern Wisconsin, and it's completely different. You know, the lifestyle and the experiences of the people are so different. But I think the piece that journalism taught me was to be curious, to be open, to be empathetic. The greatest compliment that I've received from those who have read The Kindest Lie so far is that the readers can tell that I had love and respect and empathy for Midnight and his family, as well as for Ruth and hers. And that meant a lot to me, because I'm coming at it, obviously, from the perspective of being a Black woman in America. But I really wanted to create a character in Midnight that people could really understand and relate to, and understand where he and his family were also coming from as well. And so I think journalism has helped me to unlock that and to ask the right questions and to dig deeper to find the story behind the headlines, to get the deeper story and the meaning behind it.
Going off of that a little bit, I also think like your setting is just so palpably real, and just like the atmosphere around where these characters live. You said you went into so many communities and saw so many parts of the world. Was that at all part of, do you think, helped you create this world that they are literally living in as well?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I worked in Wisconsin for a while, but then I moved to Florida and worked in Tampa Bay and West Palm Beach as a reporter as well. And so I have been in a lot of communities as a reporter, places where I normally wouldn't go, maybe. You know, because these are communities that I wouldn't naturally enter. And so that's something that is comfortable for me, kind of stepping into other worlds. And so I did bring that, I think, to the setting of the book. Also, I have family in Gary, Indiana, you know, which is more of a, you know, kind of a steel town, factory town type place. And then also I have family in Anderson, Indiana, where there was a Delco Remy General Motors plant that got shuttered some years ago. And so I visit family there periodically in Indiana. And so I think I drew upon some of those places to try to paint the picture of what the town might be like.
Yeah, because it's not a real town, right?
This Ganton is not real.
It's yeah, like, Joe and I were endlessly Googling, like, this has got to be real.
No, right? It's fictitious. But a composite of places I may have visited.
It's amazing.
My imagination, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I got about not far. I mean, like maybe 20% into the book. And I was like, where is this in Indiana? Like, and I was Googling it and I was like trying to place it. It felt so incredibly real.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
Well, especially because I think like it feels so tangible because it is so close to us in that way. And that, it just made it so much more fulfilling to read it. Cause again, it just felt like people who like I have seen in a place that I have definitely been.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt very familiar to me as well. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that Michael and I love when we see in literary fiction is the Midwest portrayed in all its complexity. Because I feel so often we kind of get dismissed here in Middle America as, you know,
it's always New York or LA.
Right.
Yes.
I see the Midwest in books.
Yeah. We have complicated issues and educated and complicated people facing real challenges. And I loved how that was captured.
Yeah.
Oh, good, good.
One of the other things that really resonated for me in The Kindest Lie was the complicated situation. So Ruth and her mother and her brother are all operating from this place of trying to do the right thing. And Ruth views what has happened as a lie. And her family's continued reluctance to discuss it as this kind of roadblock that she's trying to barrel through. And it feels like throughout the narrative, she kind of collects, you know, quote unquote, proof or evidence that their actions to kind of support this version. Meanwhile, her brother, Eli, and her mother, they see their choices as kindness and support and ongoing sacrifice on her behalf. And everyone is very stuck kind of in their own view. Meanwhile, we kind of see this elasticity of thought between Ruth and her high school best friend, and ultimately between Ruth and Xavier. And I'm wondering a bit if you can talk about how you captured the differing perspectives and then revealed everyone's motivations in such a, I just felt like it was lovingly thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And when everyone's eyes finally opened to the complexity of everyone else's perspective, it was just such a beautiful moment. And you couldn't help but feel so much love and empathy for all of the characters.
That's so beautifully said. You know, when I crafted it, when I first wrote the book, I wrote the first version with 4 point of view characters, actually.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I had it from the perspective of Ruth and Midnight, as well as Mama, who's the grandmother, mm-hmm. and Eli, the brother. So I had all four of their points of view, and that's the way I wrote it. But then I got feedback from those in the literary and publishing world that, you know, it was a little too scattered and, and dispersed, and that it really needed to be more focused on, you know, at least 2 points of view. And I think that made sense. I think I was able to still capture the perspectives of Mama, the grandmother, and Eli through the eyes of Ruth. I think it still worked. And the beauty of it is that I did not want a book where anybody was completely right or completely wrong. You know, I didn't, there are no extremes. I wanted it to be that everybody in the novel has a point, you know, and it's just that you don't know their point. You don't understand their perspective because it's not you. It's not your lived experience. And you're only looking at it from the prism of your own life experience. And that's what I was exploring with Ruth, as well as with Mama and Eli, you know, because Mama's made a lot of sacrifices. She's seen things in her life that Ruth could never really imagine going through, things that she's only read about or heard about in the history books, you know, seen on, you know, in news clips, you know, things from coming up in the South, you know, and the discrimination and the things that went on. And so she understands, I think, Mama does on a visceral level, that sometimes you have to make big moves. And I think Mama says in the book that sometimes leaving is the best way. You know, because her family left Mississippi after a traumatic racial incident so that the family could escape and have a better life. And so she sees that as a way out sometimes, as leaving. And so that's why she's like, you've got to leave this town behind in order to have a future. And that's why I've lied. That's why she has lied and kept secrets. And that's why it's considered the kindest lie, because it is done out of love and for the very best of reasons. It may be misguided, but there were reasons that she told that particular lie.
Something else too, that I'm going to say, I'm not really sure how I'm going to end this thought, but something that I kept thinking about reading it was this concept of ownership of memory and how Ruth's memory going back home, she kind of immediately gets into, I want to say old routine, but old feelings, like seeing her grandfather and the way that she used to imagine him there was taking precedence over the current state of reality for her grandmother, and her sort of choosing to move on finally. And I just found that so interesting, this concept of our ownership of our own memories and how it can take precedence over reality sometimes. And I'm just wondering, again, I don't know how to finish that, but it just came into my head, and I love that part.
I know what you're saying. I like that. I just jotted that down. Like ownership of memory. I'm going to start using that now.
Oh, good.
Very good. I definitely think that's the case. I mean, because Ruth, she's somebody who tried to leave her past behind, but in so many ways she's tethered to it. Mm-hmm. And when she goes back to Ganton, she's confronted with it right away. And she does relive the moments of security, you know, with her grandfather and what life was like, you know, when the auto plant was still open and mm-hmm. when she would go down to the water bank and fish with her grandfather. And, you know, she was able to recapture some of that. And I think that was important in terms of her state of mind and going back
right
to her beginning. But also it was interesting that when she went back home, it's kind of like she became a little girl again when she was in her grandmother's exactly. house with her brother, you know? And I think that's true for so many of us.
Yeah, oh, of course.
Adults, when you go home, you know, you're a kid again in your parents' house. And so she was experiencing that return home too. And then her time with Natasha, you know, they had their struggles, you know? Mm-hmm. And when she's sitting on Natasha's bed and they're playing the childhood clapping game, hand clapping game, they're little girls again. And they're... Mm-hmm. Reverting back to memories from childhood and the wounds of childhood and the things that separated them that they really didn't understand and couldn't talk about as girls and as teenagers that are now resurfacing through memory and having that time together and being reunited again.
Yeah, I'm just turning that over in my head now. So much, especially coming off of the holiday season when so many of us were not able to travel and go home this year. It sort of set up the holidays. Instead of going home and kind of picking up your role that you always have, it was this weird kind of navigating a new path. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't really thought about that perspective of owning your memories.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That was a good one.
Amazing. Let's talk for a minute about Midnight. He so wants to be. He wants to excel, and he's a good kid, but he's just incredibly ignorant of the danger that he causes for his best friend, Corey. And, you know, moreover, the implications of Corey's life on Ruth are so heartbreaking. And the final scene between Ruth and Midnight and Corey and the final conversation between Midnight and Ruth were so emotional. And you can feel Ruth's urgency to get Midnight to understand, what he has done and what his whiteness brings to the situation. I'm just so curious, how did the Midnight story come for you?
Yeah, that was, you know, certainly one of the more powerful pieces because Midnight is very complex. And I love the fact that you said, Jill, that Midnight is a good kid because he is a good kid. Mm-hmm. He's a very well-intentioned kid. He's, and that's the thing. When I created Midnight, I wanted a character who could interact with Ruth, who's very different from Ruth. And they're complete opposites, obviously, in terms of, you know, one's black, one's white, one's an adult, one's a child. But they both share this common need for family connection. Mm-hmm. They're both looking for something and they can fill a need for the other. And so that's what I was trying to create in the character of Midnight. And he is well-intentioned and he's adrift, you know, he's a kid who's mm-hmm. kind of lived on the outside of things and he wants to be part of something. You know, he's lost his mother. You know, he's got a dad who, you know, is pretty much a bigot and who is out of work and out of hope and out of control, you know, and he's got a grandmother who's too busy, you know, to really spend the time with him. And so he's looking for something, he's seeking, and that's why he becomes friends, I think, with, you know, Corey and Sebastian and Pancho, and he's looking for that connection, and he sees it in these Black boys, and that's why they call him Midnight, you know, and he doesn't know if they're making fun of him or if they really like him or not. But yeah, Midnight is oblivious, totally oblivious, though, to the differences, you know, in terms of being a white boy and the privilege that that gives him. And so when we're in the convenience store, for example, you know, he doesn't understand the way the owner of that convenience store, the way he's in this position of power and control as a white man, an authority figure, he doesn't understand how that lands differently with Corey, who has already had the talk with from his parents and knows the way that he has to comport himself now as a Black boy in America. That's totally oblivious to Midnight for Midnight. And Midnight later in the book is just consumed with his own pain and feeling that he's been manipulated in some way and let down yet again. And so that's what he's leading with. And he doesn't see the danger that he puts his best friend in. He can't understand that because he is so consumed with his own pain.
I'm remembering now too how just like that little kid logic, you know, he had just been, Midnight was just like, okay, now Ruth will be my mom and Ruth will take that place. And that I remember reading that almost that's sort of the same thing as like, just like, obviously that's not going to work Midnight. And I wish I could tell him that and just feeling like endless sorrow for him while also just like really wishing, for him to be better as well.
I know. And it was tough for me to try to figure out, I struggled a lot with how to wrap his storyline up, you know what I mean? Because, I wanted a sense of hope at the end and I know you all have read it. And so I think it ends on this, note of hope. Certainly for some of the characters, but you know, it's still, up in the air and ambiguous for Midnight. It's still somewhat sad because we don't know what the future really is going to hold for him. And so I wanted to have that, feeling of ambiguity about his future, at the end.
Well, and I think it's like hopeful, but not saccharine. Like it just feels so real. The hope is so real.
I think so.
Yeah, I texted Michael when I was reading it and starting to approach the end. And I said, I equal parts. I go, this would make a terrible end and ruin the book. I want like Midnight to go home with Ruth and Xavier and live happily ever after.
I know.
That would be terrible. Right. And if I read that, I would hate it. You want that for him. But then I equal parts want to shake him. Just be like, I really, really, really need you to see what's going on here.
Right. Which is like, Ruth is kind of like doing that in a kinder way than what we're saying. She's just like sitting down with him, talking to him in levels that he understands, and just like Jill's saying she agrees with Ruth, basically.
So true. And then that was another part, since we're kind of doing spoilers, I guess, in this part, is that a part that I struggled with and I talked to a few people about, one being Sarah Paretsky, the author, mystery author. She lives here in Chicago and we discussed it as well as when I was writing it, is I was really torn in that scene that you were just talking about where Ruth and Midnight are discussing what happened like after the scene at the river. Mm-hmm. And I just was trying to decide, should she forgive him? And so I was just vacillating and it was just, you know, I just kind of landed on the fact that she couldn't yet, you know, she couldn't say, I forgive you. And I guess I just thought about all the Black people throughout history who just forgive over and over and over again. And, and sometimes, you know, forgiveness can be wonderful and it's that gift that frees you, but you know, it doesn't have to happen right away and you don't have to forgive if you don't want to and you're not ready to do it. And so I wanted to reflect that in the narrative.
I think that is fair. I think that
absolutely.
Like, Ruth's asked to forgive a lot.
Yes. And I thought that scene really captured for me the emotional labor that we expect of Black women in narrating the differences in the racial divide. And Ruth being like, you know what? In this one instance, I'm not doing it.
I'm not ready. Right.
Yeah.
And being like, yeah, and you shouldn't have to.
right. So it's like, she's not going to forgive.
Yeah, good for her.
Yeah.
So this is a part where we like might make you feel a little uncomfortable, but the kind of
embarrass like, you.
Yeah. Your book is getting so much praise. It's on so many must lists, Good Housekeeping, Bustle, Black Business Guide, and so many more that we like literally don't have time to name all of them. It received a starred review from Publishers Weekly, and it was actually recently selected as an Indie Next List pick. What has all of this hype been like for you? Is your head spinning? Are you exhausted? Are you overwhelmed? Are you all of the above?
All of the above. And it's a library reads pick as well.
Now. Oh, perfect.
So, yeah.
So, and a book list.
Book list starred review came in about recently. And so, yeah, my head has been spinning. It's just been, I've been loving all the praise. You know, you don't know what to expect when you put a book into the world. You have no idea. And I worried a lot about how people would receive it. So the fact that people have given it such a warm reception has been just really gratifying. And I think the best part though is that, actual readers, everyday readers are starting to, read it and connect with it. And people who are not, you know, who don't have these particular life experiences have been writing to me. I mean, one woman said, I think she's got like a grandmother who's Jewish and Belgian. And she's like, oh, you know, my grandmother is just like mama in the book. And she makes hot water cornbread. And she also keeps bacon drippings on the stove. And she does the same things that mama does in the book. And so she connected with that, you know, one element of the book. And so that's been fun just to see all of the commonalities and the universalities in our stories and that we can find some connection. And that's the best part is just getting to hear from readers and having them love the book.
I'm so happy for you. And I think that kind of what you were saying before, like the empathy, like surrounds this book. And I think that it, is such a lovely book to warm up to. Like in the, like Jill said, it was just like, I felt so calm and, focused actually, like reading it in the middle of like all of this horrible turmoil. And I honestly just can't stop thinking about the fact that you actually started to write this during Obama's administration. It's just so wild to me to have to then put it out after the last shitty 4 years that we've had.
You can say that, it's true. Yes. It's all cyclical, you know?
And yeah, exactly.
One period mirrors the next.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the one of the things that just kind of overwhelmingly struck me is that it just makes for such a good conversation. There were so many aspects. Michael and I try not to talk to each other too much when we're reading because we find it spoils our conversation in the podcast. But there were so many times that we would talk and I would be like, okay, I'm going to say one thing and don't respond in any way so that we can talk about it more later. Because there were just, it weaves in and out of so many complexities, but it does it with ease and with empathy. And I just so appreciated that. It was such a pleasure to read.
Oh, good. It's wonderful to hear that from you. I really appreciate that.
We want to thank Nancy Johnson and the marketing team over at William Morrow for their help in making The Kindest Lie available to us for today's episode and as our Book It Book Club first inaugural pick. Nancy, thank you so much for being here today.
This was so much fun. I just really love this conversation.
So do we.
Nancy Johnson is an Emmy-nominated, award-winning television journalist. Her debut novel, which we have been discussing today, is both a Publishers Weekly Star Review title and an Indie Next pick. As our inaugural Book It Book Club pick, we look forward to discussing this title with you over on Instagram. So be sure to join us over there at Book It Pod.
Let's talk.
Oh. It was such a good interview.
It was such a good interview, and she was so delightful. She was something I think is not a surprise, but continues to just like warm my little heart is just how approachable and fun and generous the authors always are when they come on to our podcast. And Nancy Johnson was no exception there. She was just so generous with what she shared with us, and I learned so much about her process.
Yeah, and I my new favorite thing I think might be people with journalistic backgrounds who then write books, because
yeah,
that just seems to do something to your brain.
Yes, it fully immerses you in the literal world of their stories naturally, because so much of what journalistic writing is observing and observation of place, and the similarities there between, as we said, between The Daughters of Eerytown by Connie Schultz and The Kindest Lie are really profound. I mean, mm-hmm. the feeling of place is just so apparent in The Kindest Lie.
Yeah. I was thinking, I was just kind of rolling this over in my head, just really in the last like 5 minutes, so this might not come out in a coherent
way. I hope it doesn't.
Yeah. But I just kind of realized we've really been on a kick lately of multi-perspective fiction.
Right. Right.
And I'm just so curious. I'm curious about how that impacts the story.
Yeah, I was thinking that the other day too, because I was listening back to our season premiere episode, and I mentioned that a couple of years ago, it felt like every book was being written from multi-perspective narrative. And so it was kind of hard to decide at that time if it was necessary. And I feel like that has died down a little bit and has made the multi-narrative perspective like really, really good, because not everyone's doing it anymore. Like, people are realizing, oh, I don't have to tell my story this way. So the ones that we're reading are so good. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I think The Kindest Lie couldn't have been told from one perspective. I think the impact is because this singular thing has so many perspectives on it, and it's complicated for that reason. And I think that exploring it from multi-perspectives is really important.
Yeah, the if you think of it like a drop of water, the ripple effect that comes away, that moves off of Ruth giving birth and her mother, you know, basically setting up a private illegal adoption.
Yeah.
It just would not have the nuance.
Exactly.
If we heard it from one voice, if we only mm-hmm. knew, if we were only seeing the story through Ruth's eyes, I don't know that we could as deeply understand the love that Eli and her mother have for her, or how deep their love is, that they mm-hmm. have lived with this mm-hmm. lie in a way that she didn't have to.
Totally. Yes, exactly.
For this and whole time.
The idea, that complicated, sometimes like not even real difference between a secret and a lie. Like,
yeah.
Without those perspectives, one, it helps us remain kind of neutral. Like, if it was completely from Ruth's perspective, it would be really easy to like deeply sympathize and empathize exclusively with her, of course. But the point of a multi-perspective story is to complicate your feelings about it, because it doesn't make it any more or less easy to distill what is right and wrong, but it helps you understand why they decided to do what they did, mm-hmm. and the separate burdens placed upon each of them for that. She was just, that was very apparent. And
yeah.
the thing that was wild, I think you all will have heard, was that she's been writing the story forever.
Yeah, I was blown away by that, because when I was reading it, I was reading it through this lens of assumptions that I had made.
Right.
I'm like all the characters in the story. I was operating under a set of incorrect assumptions.
If we weren't, it's because of the specific moment in time. Like, it feels like a book that is in response to this really shitty era.
Yeah.
But also, like, I have said before on this, like, I'm trying to be a writer, and I would love to be published someday. And
you are a writer. Who will be published one day.
It's hard for me to... Well, anyway, we'll get into that some other time. I like hearing when something was a long process. Like, mm-hmm. I get really intimidated by seeing authors who are just, like, turning them out year after year after year. And I'm just like, I can't do that. And it makes me feel like I'm not good enough. So it's a good reminder that there are so many different ways to be successful at this thing. Take your time on the story you want to write. If that's how you write, there's nothing wrong with that. It was just really helpful.
Yeah, I agree. So from here, I know that we're going to be interacting with people on our social media and on our website about The Kindest Lie. Can you, like, walk us through? What's our plan? What are we doing, Michael?
Yeah, at this point, hopefully you've read the book. And
if not, read it right now.
Right, exactly. But if you haven't, head on over to our social media and you'll see prompts that we've been posting the last couple of weeks, questions that we ask each other and our community about certain chapters and certain perspectives. And if you head to our website, we have a book club questionnaire type document that you can share with your book club. I highly recommend reading this with the book club. If not ours, introduce it to yours and use our questionnaire to start conversations going. And we hope to continue this throughout the year with a couple of other books. And we have some lined up that I'm so excited about.
It's too early to tell people, but
I
am equally excited about our next pick.
Cannot wait.
And I mean, I'm going to embarrass myself, but I'm going to say it anyway because I've started. I figured out last night that I had accidentally turned off all of my notifications on Instagram. So every time anyone was tagging me in the replies on our Instagram page, I was not aware.
On Bookits?
Yeah. But now I am. So as we're talking about this, I can participate.
Absolutely.
I have a sixth grade understanding. I don't even have a sixth grade understanding of Instagram. No. No. My child helped me fix my Instagram settings.
Well, your child also taught me what sus means. And that has completely changed my life.
I have to tell you, you asked me several weeks ago about CAP.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, okay. This will be lovely because it's in our podcast. Here's a follow-up.
Is it? Oh yeah. Okay. So here's a follow-up. Okay. It's about it's like saying like facts, you know, it's like if you say something and you're like CAP, it's like when you and I text each other and we go, oh my gosh, same or so true.
Oh.
It's CAP.
What?
I don't know what to say. I demanded an explanation yesterday. This is brand new, hot off the press information for me. So I assume everyone will stop saying it like tomorrow.
Right. It probably already have. Okay. Yeah. So
by the time this airs, everyone's going to be like, no one says that anymore, Jill.
Stop saying that, Mom.
Yeah.
Listen, for more hot takes on new language and all of your bookish content, please go follow us over on social media. We're at Twitter and Instagram at BookitPod. And visit our website, again, for book club stuff. And just for – we post blogs. We have book lists, everything. Go head over to BookitPod.com and spend some time with us.
Sounds good.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books.
Book It is available across podcast platforms.
Subscribe to never miss an episode, and don't forget to leave a review before you go.
We'd love to stay in touch. You can find us online at bookitpod.com or on Instagram and Twitter at bookitpod.
Want to read something you heard on today's episode? Visit us at bookshop.org/shop/bookitpod.
Book It was created by hosts Jill Burkett-Rekasey and Michael Woodson, with sound design and production by Honeysuckler.